We're in Luke 22 and 23 this morning, if you want to turn there, as we continue this study through the Gospel of Luke as we prepare for Easter. And we started with the triumphal entry quite a few weeks ago, and have been following the progression of Jesus last week there in Jerusalem. And today we come to the trials. I'm going to call this message the fourth courtroom. The fourth courtroom, and you'll see why as we proceed here. But I know the children are in the service today. There's no junior church, so when we do this, I try to give you some key words to listen for to help you as you follow along. So if you've got a bulletin and you're taking notes, children or others who want to go along with this, here are some key words that you're going to hear in the message today, and then put a little mark or a tally mark next to each time you hear one of those words. And it'll help you as you listen to follow along. But our words to listen for today are going to be trial. Trial. Guilt. Guilt. And then evidence. Evidence. Listen for that word. And then finally, one more, judgment. Judgment. So obviously, you get the theme here. We're in a courtroom today. We're going to be in a number of courtrooms: trial, guilt, evidence, and judgment. Most of us, at some point in our lives, have been in a courtroom for various reasons. Maybe you were there on a field trip. Maybe you were summoned for jury duty. It's possible that you've been a witness at some point in a trial, or maybe you've even been on trial. I don't know. I know we've been to Judge Puffenberger's courtroom, I think, more times than I can count now. And we're on a first-name basis, me and Jack, because of the number of adoptions that we have gone through ourselves and with family members and friends, and it's fun to always go into that courtroom. And I know he always likes telling us that adoption day is his favorite day of the week, because the rest of the week he has to deal with stuff that's not so fun. But you know, a courtroom is a solemn place, and if you've been there, I mean, you know, just by the woodwork and the furniture and the high ceilings, and you get this sense that there's a lot of important things that happen there. There's decorum, and there's formalities that you don't have in other places that you would find in a courtroom. There's this almost sacred sense of justice that hangs over there, because significant life-altering decisions are made in courtrooms every day. And today in our text, Jesus is going to enter the courtroom. In fact, he's going to enter three courtrooms. He's going to be shuffled throughout Jerusalem. And each of these courtrooms that he enters into is going to be presided over by a different type of judge. But they're all going to be sharing in common the fact that they fail to uphold justice. And the reason for these different courtrooms that Jesus goes through in Jerusalem in this day is because Israel is not a sovereign nation at this point. They are under Roman rule. The Roman Empire is controlling them. And the Romans were smart enough to give local governments some autonomy, some of their own authority. But there were certain things that the local government couldn't do, that Rome would have to do. And in this case, because they wanted to seek the death penalty for Jesus, the Jewish leaders had to get Roman approval. So there's a number of different courts that he's going to have to go through. Today, when somebody is sentenced to death, it often takes 10, 20 years. It's a lengthy process with all of the appeals and everything else that goes into that. For Jesus, all three of his hearings are packed into one morning, and things are rushed quite quickly. And we're going to look then at each of these courtrooms. We'll walk through them together. But let me first pray. Gracious Father, we pray that as we come to your word today, we will have our hearts and minds opened, and that we also will understand that that Jesus is being tested here, and that those who are putting him on trial are being tested. So Lord, help us to be able to see Jesus for who he is and to weigh the evidence carefully and to walk in your ways. Amen. The first courtroom that Jesus appears in here is actually a courtyard, not a room. And he goes before the Jewish council. We see this in chapter 22, beginning in verse 66. Let me read that for you. It says, "When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council, and they said, 'If you are the Christ, tell us.' But he said to them, 'If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God.' So they all said, 'Are you the Son of God then?' And he said to them, 'You say that I am.' Then they said, 'What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips.'" Now, it's helpful to understand this council. It's probably about 70 leaders from the Jewish community. It includes the priests, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the scribes. And they were known for following very strict rules. They had a very prescribed fashion in which a trial was to take place. But in the trial of Jesus, they threw the rule book out the window. They did none of the things that they were supposed to do. They held their proceedings in the wrong location. Court was supposed to have been held at the temple. They hold it here in a courtyard. They held their proceedings on the wrong day. A trial wasn't supposed to happen on a holy day like the Passover. They followed the wrong process. Those on trial were supposed to be given an opportunity for a fair defense. Jesus was never given that. They followed wrong deliberations. Their verdict was not to have been rendered on the same day as the trial. And yet they wait no time at all in declaring Jesus guilty. These are just four. There are at least three other ways in which they broke their own rules when they put Jesus on trial that day. And seeing the injustice of all this, Jesus is not wasting what little breath he has in trying to defend himself. But when asked if he is the Christ or the Messiah, he doesn't answer directly, but instead quotes the Old Testament. He says, "From now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And this council knows the Bible. They know what Jesus means when he says this. And so they ask him to clarify, and they realize that the Son of Man is the same as the Son of God, who is sent directly from God and who will enjoy immediate access to God. Jesus knows this is true. But he keeps the council on their toes when he says, in effect, "If you say so, that's who you say that I am. Okay." And that's really all the council wants to hear. They believe they have a charge against Jesus that will hold up now in the Roman court. And they quickly shuffle him off to courtroom number two. So now we come to courtroom number two, beginning in chapter 23 and verse 1. "Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king.' And Pilate asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And he answered him, 'You have said so.' Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, 'I find no guilt in this man.' But they were urgent, saying, 'He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place.' When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time." So we've gone from the Jewish court now to the Roman court. This is the court of Pilate. And again, not a formal courtroom, but probably another courtyard outside Pilate's Jerusalem apartment. Pilate didn't live in Jerusalem. He was there on occasion. He would come at busy times like Passover because his desire was to keep the peace. And Pilate doesn't want anything going wrong when all these people are in Jerusalem. Pilate's a Roman. He's not Jewish. He's been appointed by Caesar to oversee the region of Palestine. And he doesn't want to be here. He wants to be in Rome. He has ambitions. He has desires for power. And he's feeling stuck in this backwater city when all the action is in Rome. He wants to move out of here as quick as he can, but he knows he's got to keep the peace. He has no idea that the verdict he renders on this day will be the most important judgment rendered in all of history. And that what happens in his courtyard courtroom is going to have more impact on the trajectory of the Roman Empire than even Julius Caesar's rise to power. That everything is going to change because of the decision Pilate makes on this day. But he has no idea of this. The council comes to Pilate prosecuting Jesus with three charges. Charge number one they bring before Pilate, they say he's misleading the nation of Israel. Pilate doesn't care. He's not really concerned about the nation of Israel. Charge number two, they say that Jesus is forbidding the payment of taxes to Caesar. Now, this might concern Pilate, since he's got something to do with the collection of taxes. But the charge is entirely fabricated, and it's very easy to see because he had just been questioned about this, and Jesus had said very clearly, pay to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's. But it's the third charge that Pilate's most interested in. This is them saying that he has claimed to be the Messiah, that is, the King of the Jews. And if this is so, if Jesus is claiming to be a king, then that means he's in competition with Caesar. He's in competition with Pilate. He's a threat to Roman rule. But anybody can see that the facts don't really line up. If Jesus is leading a revolt, where are all his followers? And that's why they're trying to argue with him here in verse 5. They say, he stirs up the people, honest, teaching all of Judea and Galilee and all this. And Pilate's sitting here saying, where are they all? They've all scattered. If Jesus is a real threat to the throne, where's his army? It's not there. So Pilate's unconvinced. He's unconcerned. Verse 4, he simply declares, I have found no guilt in this man. His verdict is rendered. The next step should be obvious. Jesus should be set free. And this all should end. But the people don't want that. The people are angry. They're upset. They want Jesus dead. And Pilate is looking for a way to gain some political points. He wants to be popular with the people. He's done some things that weren't popular. Now he sees an opportunity to maybe make up for past mistakes. And so he finds out that Jesus is a Galilean. And then he connects the dots here. He realizes, oh, well, Herod oversees Galilee, and Herod's in Jerusalem right now. I'll send him there. So he punts to the next courtroom. And Herod and Pilate didn't always get along, but now maybe there's an opportunity to mend the fence. Herod was always looking forward to an opportunity of meeting Jesus. Now Pilate can provide him that. So he sends him off to Herod, and this is the third courtroom now that we are entering into. Courtroom number 3 begins here in verse 8. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. And Herod, with his soldiers, treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. So courtroom number 3 is Herod's courtroom. And, you know, rather than being put off by the idea of having to deal with Jesus as Pilate was, Herod seems kind of excited. he's kind of eager to meet this guy and see what he can do. He's heard Jesus does miracles, so maybe he'll do some kind of trick for me that I can see. And he's been wanting to see this for a while, and so now he brings Jesus in, and he's hoping that he'll put on a show, but he doesn't. This was not the same Herod that met the Magi, if you remember the Christmas story, and this is not the same Herod who ordered the execution of all the babies in Bethlehem in an attempt to kill Jesus. There were numerous Herods. That was a title, more or less, kind of a family name. And so this is a different guy. This is the one who did kill John the Baptist. But he's kind of just fascinated with Jesus at this point. And he starts to bombard him with questions. And when Jesus doesn't answer his questions, he gets angry. He begins to mock him. And they dress him up as if he were a king and send him back to Pilate. So now we're back in the second courtroom again. This shuffling about continues, picking up in verse 12. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, and he said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I do not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him." I find that kind of remarkable that he says like three times he did nothing deserving death, nothing, he's not guilty, he's innocent, therefore I'll punish him. But I think Pilate's seeking some sort of compromise because he doesn't want to issue the execution order. Pilate's three times declared that Jesus is not guilty, but the crowd is overwhelming. They want Jesus crucified. What we see in these three courtrooms is a corruption of many things. There's a corruption in these courtrooms, and courtroom number one was corrupted, we have seen, by a desire for power. A desire for power. The Jewish council saw in Jesus a threat to their power, and because of that, their justice was corrupted. Courtroom number two was corrupted by a desire for popularity. Pilate saw in Jesus an opportunity to win popularity with the people. And so he decided he wasn't going to pursue the truth. He was simply going to score political points. Courtroom number three was corrupted by a desire for pleasure. Herod saw Jesus in Jesus a way to be entertained. Jesus might give him some pleasure. He might do some kind of trick for him. And so that's what he was hoping for. And when he didn't get that, he just mocked him and sent him on his way. When justice is corrupted, these are often the reasons why. Some might be seeking power, others might be seeking popularity or pleasure of some kind instead of the truth. And these judges are, all throughout this story, believing that they live and operate on a plane much higher than Jesus. Their pursuits of power, their quest for political popularity, their desire for pleasure, need not answer to this lowly prophet from Nazareth in their minds. But they could not have been more wrong. Jesus said it himself in verse 69, if they had only listened. He said, "From now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." Meaning he will be the judge of the judges, and everything will be reversed. They could not see the king beneath the blood and the thorns. Jesus will one day judge the living and the dead, but he came first to be judged by a court and by each of us in the courtrooms of our hearts. Because there's a fourth courtroom in this story. It's not the courtyard where the council met. It's not the courtyard outside of Pilate's apartment. It's not Herod's Jerusalem palace. But the fourth courtroom in this story is the courtroom of your heart. You cannot sincerely listen to this story without the same Jesus being ushered into the courtroom of your heart. And there you also must render a verdict of life or death. Will Jesus live in you today? Or will you, like Pilate and Herod, drive him away? The judge of all people has subjected himself to the judgment of all people. And you might be quick to say, you know what, I don't want that kind of responsibility. That's above my pay grade. I am not a judge. No one, I never asked to do this. Nobody appointed me to be in this position, but somebody has. God requires each of us to render a decision for or against. Will it be life or will it be death? Jesus came into this world as a man to be put on trial in the courtroom of every human heart. Your verdict will have no more lasting effect on Jesus than the verdicts of any others, because he is Lord, whether you say so or not. But there is a profound and lasting effect on you and on what you are able to do in this world. Romans 10:9 says, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That's a judgment. That's a verdict. To believe in your heart, in the courtroom of your heart, that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. So how do we choose? If now that responsibility is upon us, in the courtroom of our heart, how will the proceeding go? Well, I would say first, weigh the evidence. Weigh the evidence. As C.S. Lewis famously said, Jesus only leaves us with three options. Either Jesus is a liar, or he's a lunatic, or he is Lord. Because based on the claims that he himself made, he can only be one of these three. There's no real option of saying, you know, he was just a really nice guy who said some kind things. Either you must judge him a liar because he intentionally deceived others when he claimed that he was God. Or you got to judge him a lunatic because he thought he was God. And only lunatics think that they are God. Or you believe him to be exactly who he said he was. And that is Lord over all. Weigh the evidence. I remember as a high school student, I started looking more at the evidence and trying to understand for myself. I remember a book I got in high school by Josh McDowell. It was called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It was kind of a classic. It was almost written like a law book in which he just laid out as much of the evidence as he possibly could for the historicity of Jesus, the validity of the Bible, the trustworthiness of Christianity and the resurrection. And it was a great book, and there are so many great resources out there to examine, to study. Look at the facts. Study the matter. Lee Strobel has done a great job of this, and many of the books and the movies that they've done with him, the case for Christ, the case for grace, the case for a creator, the case for all of these things. And he was a journalist and an atheist, and yet he went and when he studied the evidence, he became convinced. Christians need not fear the facts. Reason is on our side. G.K. Chesterton said, the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. Because the evidence in the case of Jesus was clear. Pilate said it three times. He knew it. Jesus was an innocent man. The problem wasn't the evidence. The problem was the pressure. The problem was the others claiming something else. So weigh the evidence. And second, examine your own heart. examine your own heart. The first three courtrooms that we looked at this morning were biased by wrong desires. The desire for power, the desire for popularity, the desire for pleasure. They each decided against Jesus, not because of the evidence, but because of misguided desires. And so examine the desires of your heart. How are they influencing your decision for or against Jesus? And this is the hard part. Because Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? Jeremiah 17:10 answers the question. It says, I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind. And this is where trust comes in. You have to admit, your judgment's biased. And you can't see clearly without the grace of God. And this is where the skeptic always stumbles, because this trust can look like a blind leap into darkness, but it isn't. Jesus opened the way. You see for yourself who he is and what he's done, and by the grace of God, your eyes are opened, your ears are opened, and the light comes in. It's because we are never detached from our decision for or against Jesus. We don't live outside our decision. We live inside it every moment of every day. It steers us from the top of our head to the bottom of our feet every moment. Because remember, this fourth courtroom is your heart. We don't stand outside of it. It is who we are. It is our deepest passion and desire. It is the seat of our very being. It is the engine of our love and our hope and our joy. And so we must give him our all. And then we can see clearly. And we can sing this song that we're going to close with here today. I was glad to see that this one was selected, Be Thou My Vision. It's a great song because when we sing this song, if we mean it, we render a verdict, don't we? Our verdict is for Jesus. That we call for him to be our vision, to be the one we follow with all of our hearts. Gracious Lord, I pray that as Christ enters the courtroom of our heart, we will weigh the evidence clearly, and that we will examine our own desires and be changed by you. Help us, Lord, to receive your truth and to walk in faithfulness, that we will be set free as Christ has come to set us free. Help him to be our vision today. In Jesus' name, amen.